You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 26. I'm Chris Webster.
And I'm April Camp Whitaker. On today's show, we're going to be talking to British archaeologist Sir Barry Cunliffe.
Let's dig a little deeper. Okay, welcome back to the Archaeology Podcast, the Archaeology Show, I should say. We've got two episodes back, episode 24. We interviewed Sir Barry Cunliffe about his new book, which, as you're listening to this, should be out in the UK. And that's called On the Ocean. And go back and listen to that show. We'll link it in the show notes. It was a fantastic discussion about early prehistoric to about AD 1500 seafaring and ships in the Mediterranean and the Atlantic and all over the place. So it's a really great conversation. But today we welcome back Sir Barry Cunliffe. He's a British archaeologist. An emeritus professor at the University of Oxford. He was professor of European archaeology at the University of Oxford from 1972 to 2007. So welcome back to the Archaeology Show, Barry Cunliffe.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be back.
All right. Well, why don't you add just a little bit to that introduction, because you've been doing archaeology over there for a really, really long time. And, and why don't you just – and that's a compliment.
Yeah. And I can still do it. Yeah.
You can still do it. Yeah, there you go. Yep. Why don't you just add a little bit more to that introduction and help us frame the conversation today?
Yep. Okay. Well, as you say, I've been at Oxford for a very long time, but I started archaeology a lot before that. When I was a small kid, I got heavily involved, and I did my first excavation, I dug on someone else's site when I was 15. And from then on, I've dug every single year since that. So that's since 1955 until now. So I've moved a lot of dirt in those years.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of hard over in England to sink a shovel in the ground without finding something, isn't it?
It is. literally everywhere. I mean, I'm now in Oxford University Press Building in the center of Oxford. I'm pretty sure that if I went out into the courtyard here and dug a hole, I'd find something of archaeological interest. You know, it might just be some potsherds or some flints or something like that. But everywhere in England, you can't miss archaeology. You trip over it.
So what were some of the first things that you were exposed to in archaeology? What like time periods, what types of artifacts, what got you into this?
Well, really, it started when I was born and brought up in Portsmouth, and Portsmouth was very, very badly bombed during the war. It was a pretty miserable place after the war. So my mother used to take me to an uncle's farm in Somerset, and I remember I was probably about 8, 9, something like that. And one day I was bored, and my uncle said, "Well, why don't you go out and into the field with a Roman villa in it and see what you can find?" So I said, "Well, where's that?" And he said, "Over there, you know, behind the orchard." So I did. I went out into the field. It was a pasture field, and I spent the rest of the holiday there just kicking over molehills and picking up tesserae, you know, little bits of coloured stone that mosaics were made from, picking up potsherds, picking up bits of window glass, Roman window glass, and Roman roof tile. It was a fantastic introduction. I didn't dig it at all, you know. I was just the moles had done the work for me. You just find this stuff. From then on, it took off. There was a villa in that field. It was excavated in about the 1820s, I subsequently found. It had very fine mosaic pavements, which are probably still there, still under the ground. And it was a most incredible start for something that's kept me off the streets ever since.
Off the streets and into the fields, right?
Exactly right.
There you go. And early on, now we talked extensively about this in the On the Ocean podcast, episode 24, but I just wanted to bring this up because it was part of your sort of growing up. You grew up in a somewhat of a seafaring town in England with I think you said your father was in the Navy and possibly your grandfather as well. Is that right?
That's right. My grandfather was in the Navy when they still had sailing ships. He joined the Navy. He was in the Navy in the 1870s, 1880s. Mm-hmm. And he was what was called a fore topsailsman. He was in charge of the top sail on the foremast of the sailing ship. I've got the whole of his naval record, which is fantastic, all the ships he's sailed on. One occasion, he had an accident, and of course the British Navy recorded all these things meticulously, and it described this accident, how a hawser broke and recoiled and broke his toe, and the last line in this record, he was sober at the time, which I thought was a rather nice let out. But so my grandfather was in the Navy, and he retired to Portsmouth and taught naval gunnery, and my father was in the Navy as well, and in the Second World War.
Nice. So at what point did you were interested in some of the stuff you were seeing when you were younger, and then went to university for this. At what point did you become interested in I guess boats and seafaring and things like that from an archaeological perspective?
I think it's always been there, really. Portsmouth is a big naval town, and you can't forget the sea. It's all around you. So it was sort of in my blood. And the first excavations I did were not very far. I did them with my school in Portsmouth. Mm-hmm. There was a school teacher there who ran a little excavation on the South Downs. You can see the sea from the South Downs. So I started working there when I was 14, 15. I suppose I really first became aware of the importance of the sea when I started the first excavation that I did, first decent size excavation I did by myself, which I directed, which was in 1961 at a place called Porchester Castle, which is in the upper part of Portsmouth Harbour. It's right on the sea. And it starts off as a fort built by the Romans. It's a big fort, about 9 acres, built by the Romans to protect the coast at the time when the Saxons were beginning to raid into the English Channel. So it's one of what we call the Saxon shore forts. There are about 9 or 10 of them around the coast. And it went on in use. The Saxons settled in there. And then in the medieval period, there was a castle. It went right on to the early 19th century, at the time of the Napoleonic Wars, beginning of the 19th century, when it was a prisoner of war camp for sailors who were caught from the French Navy. So that site was absolutely linked to the sea in every single period. And I suppose it was digging there from, I started in 1961 and went on into the late 1970s. It really dragged me into this contact with the sea.
And that's one of the interesting things about England, because it's an island, so everything is sort of linked to the ocean in a way, in the end. I mean, I noticed that a lot of the sites that you've worked in you've kind of looked at trade, or they've been these kind of coastal sites.
That's right. You can't really get away very much from the sea. I mean, I'm in Oxford, I suppose I'm almost as far from the sea as I can possibly be, but it only takes me an hour to get there. So you're conscious of it. I think I have really favoured the coast in the sites that I've chosen. Most of them have been, in some way, when I look back on it, associated with the sea. And I think that's because of this sort of latent interest. I've always been drawn to be near the sea. As you say, Britain has a sort of trading nation. It's always been a trading nation. It's always been linked by the sea to Europe to start with. And people tended to think of the sea as being a divide. It wasn't. It was the thing that linked. And it was easier to travel by sea and through most of the prehistoric period than it was to travel by land. Easier and safer. So the seaways between Britain and the continent were absolutely awash with ships throughout prehistory and the historic period. You can't miss them.
So one of the sites that you worked at, which is really interesting, is Danebury. Yeah. Would you mind kind of tell Danebury, the hill fort? So would you mind telling our readers what a hill fort is and a little bit about your work there?
Yes, sure. Well, hill forts belong to what we call the Iron Age in Britain. That's a period from about 800 BC to the time when the Romans started to conquer Britain, which was in AD 43. So the latter part of the first millennium BC. And in part of Britain, it's mainly the central part of Britain, it developed this rash of hill defences in the Iron Age, in this Iron Age period. And these are, if you can imagine, a sort of roundish hill or an oblong hill or something like that, oval-shaped hill. What they did was to dig a ditch all around the contour of that hill and pile up a bank on the inside and have a couple of gates leading into it. And it was a defended place. It was a lot more than that, I think. It was a sort of symbol of your tribal identity. It was a sign of your strength, the strength of your tribe. It was a central place for trade. It was the place where your temples were and your religious ceremonies took place. And some of them were only occupied at certain times during the year, and some were occupied more or less throughout the year. So it's a sort of central settlement of a tribal nature in a territory, in a broad territory. It dominated that territory. And Danebury is a wonderful hill fort. It was largely untouched when I first began excavating there in 1968-69. And at that stage, you know, we knew really very little about hill forts. A number people had looked at hill forts before, and they'd been impressed by the gates and these defences, and they'd cut sections across the defences or excavated the gates. But very, very few people had bothered to look inside a hill fort. And what we decided to do was to really try and work out whether people use them, how much they use them, over what sort of period, how intense the occupation was, and so on. So I spent 20 happy years every summer with a team of about 40 or 50 volunteers working throughout the month of, usually the month of August, on this wonderful wooded hill, discovering the Iron Age in a way that I'd never believed possible.
Nice. Can you explain just a little bit for some of our listeners, and I'm thinking primarily myself and other listeners over here in the U.S. Exactly, because when I think hill fort and I hear you explain what it is, because this podcast is intended for a wider audience, I'm almost envisioning like the mounds that we have here in the southeastern United States and central United States, because you're mentioning how they have been excavated and people hadn't looked inside of one. Is that kind of how these things end up now, how they look now? Is they're buried features, which is why they haven't been, plundered?
No. If you go to the average hill fort now, you'll see these defenses, this big bank and ditch, and sometimes two or three lines of banks and ditches. There's one at Maiden Castle, which is massive, with about three or four lines of banks and ditches involving huge amount of energy to build, really looking dominant. But the inside area, the area enclosed by these defenses, is usually, in most cases, it's just plain grassland with nothing very much to see, unless you're in a stony part of Britain, where sometimes you can see the inundations where there were huts, hut circles we call them, where people lived. But in most of the ones, the one I excavated at Danebury, there was absolutely nothing to see on the surface. You know, you just looked like any old field. They hadn't been excavated on a large scale because, as I say, people were much more interested in the defences, the obvious bits. Also, excavating inside, you were often encroaching on farmland and so on. So there was a tendency to leave the insides alone. Also, it's much easier to dig a slice through a bank and ditch than it is to start a very large area excavation. And we were excavating, really large areas. I excavated in the end about half this hill fort, 50%. extent of, I suppose it's 9-10 acres. So you know, 4-5 acres of the site totally excavated. And it was absolutely packed with pits and post holes of houses and storage buildings and burials and temples and so on. It involved a lot of work, and you know, cost a lot of money to do as well.
So really what you were finding is that these hill forts were really thriving communities, instead of just sort of fortifications or ritual or burial sites. These are actually towns.
Yeah, well, some of them were sort of proto-towns, I think you can reasonably say, in that people live in them. We estimate for Danebury probably something like 200 to 300 people at a time living inside, so not vast. And they did all the things that normal people would do in the Iron Age. They brought their grain in and processed their grain. They stored it in great, well, they stored it, some of it in pits and some of it in overground granaries on posts above the ground. They brought in ingots of iron from outside. This isn't an iron producing area. They brought in these ingots of iron and worked them into tools. So you've got blacksmiths there. There's evidence of bronze working, casting little bronze ornaments for horse harness and things like that. The one of the main industries, the main product was wool and woolen cloth. And we found all the tools that you would need for working wool. So I think the two big products of the countryside around were grain and wool. And they used those then. I think they stockpiled this inside and then used it to exchange for other commodities that they wanted. Salt from the sea, for example. We've got evidence that salt was brought in from the sea. The metals that they couldn't get locally, they had to trade for. So these were sort of trading centers as well. But I think they were mainly, if you can think of it, the heart of essentially an agricultural society. So they were places where you would imagine the ceremonies that go with the agricultural year would be carried out. They would, particularly the sort of harvest ceremonies, when they bring in the grain for storage, and they bring in the animals which they would cull and probably feast off the ones that they had killed off, and they'd keep the animals close to the hill fort so they could tend them. So really, I think the agricultural year was the crucial thing. And also, of course, they had, as I say, temples, and we've found a number of burials inside as well, burials in pits.
So in the surrounding countryside outside of the hill fort, there would have been kind of smaller family houses that were running these agricultural fields and then bringing things into this larger central community.
Yeah, exactly that. We spent, as I say, 20 years excavating the hill fort, and then I spent about another 15 years excavating farmsteads around the hill fort. So we've got a very good idea of these little farms, probably a single family or extended family farms that were, as it were, within the territory of the hill fort. And the hill fort, they were dependent on the hill fort, and probably they were bringing a tithe of their corn and a tithe of their animals into the fort every year. And the lord there must have been some sort of coercive power. The lord there would no doubt offer them his protection from other people raiding them. So you would get this a society very much like the Irish societies that were being recorded in the Irish sagas. Very much that sort of thing.
Okay, well, on that note, we are going to take our first break, and we'll come back with more from Sir Barry Cunliffe in just a minute or so. Hey, podcast fans, check out the ARC365 podcast at www.arcpodnet.com/arc365. That's ARCH365 for your daily dose of archaeology. Each episode is less than 15 minutes long, and we have some great guests recording about awesome archaeology. We also try to throw in some definitions and basic archaeological information. So, check out the 365 Days of Archaeology podcast only in 2017 at www.arcpodnet.com/arc365 today. Find us also on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Google Music by typing ARC365 into the search. Now back to the show.
Great. Well, welcome back to the Archaeology Show, and we're talking with Barry Cunliffe. So I was realizing as we were talking about Danesbury that, you know, especially a lot of our American listeners don't have a very good sense of sort of the historical and prehistorical timeline in Britain, and where, you know, how does the Iron Age relate to the Romans and relate to, you know, some of the more popular cultural ideas that we have about things like the Celts. And so how does this timeline work a little bit, just sort of brief?
Okay. Let's take the Celts first. I think although no classical writer ever called the Britons Celts, the probability is they were Celts in the sense that they spoke the Celtic language, so that they were part of this great sort of Western European group of people who spoke a similar language and had really rather a similar culture. So that's where they belong. They are Celts, I think we could say. Now, in terms of time, we in Britain still use the old three-age system, where you divide the prehistoric period into the early Paleolithic and Mesolithic period, so the hunter-gatherer stone ages. And then the crucial time is around about 4000 BC, when agriculturalists come across from the continent and colonize Britain. And that's the beginning of the Neolithic period. And then a bit later, somewhere around 2400 BC, copper and bronze start to be used. And then somewhere around 800, 700 BC, you get the first use of iron. So although we still use these old technological terms, they're good shorthand, really we're dealing with pretty well a continuum of people. The Iron Age people in Britain didn't actually sort of come across from anywhere. They were the indigenous population whose ancestors go right back to the Neolithic and right back, I think, in many cases, to the early hunter-gatherers. There's quite a lot of early hunter-gatherer genes still around at that time.
So what you're really tracking in this earlier phase are the technological shifts as new technologies are discovered and invented, rather than kind of the later histories where you start getting sort of these cultural invasions from different groups like the Saxons and Normans and Romans.
That's right. Right at the end of the Iron Age, so we're talking about the first century BC, Britain or the southern Britain starts quite an active trade with Gaul, with France, and we begin to get Roman wine sort of trickling up through France and then being shipped across to Britain in big wine amphoras. So that's in the first century BC. So it's a sort of bow wave of Roman influence hitting us. And then as you get through the first century BC, 55 BC is a date that every English schoolboy knows, because that's when Julius Caesar landed in Britain. So the first sort of Roman invader to come to Britain was 55 BC, and Caesar raided in 55 and 54 BC, and then went away again. He didn't really make a good job of it, and he only just got away. Back to the sea again. He misjudged the sea. He didn't understand tides, for example, and got it all wrong. But anyway, that's 55, 54 BC, and from then on, Britain was trading more and more and more with France, which was at that stage Roman. Caesar had conquered France, but Britain was unconquered. So native Britain was trading with Romanized Gaul, France, at that stage. And then eventually in 43 AD, the Romans under Claudius, the Emperor Claudius, decided to come and conquer Britain. And that's when the first Romans landed on the south coast, first Roman armies of conquest landed on the south coast, and then fanned out across Britain into Wales, into Scotland. And you could say really by about the 80s of the first century AD, Britain was pretty well under Roman control.
That's really interesting. So I think when we think about British history and prehistory, we don't necessarily think about the fact that these invasions were first kind of almost a cultural and trade-based. You know, we think about military forces landing and kind of bringing in new cultures and ideas, rather than all of these groups are really interacting already in different ways. And so do you see this in some of the archaeological work you've been doing? I know you worked in places like Bath.
Yes. Well, Bath is a very interesting sort of case study because Bath is a city in the western part of Britain, and it's famous for hot springs, which bubble up from very deep down, and bringing up a lot of water, 250,000 gallons of water every day, hot water, 45 degrees centigrade, sort of bubbles out of the ground. And the prehistoric peoples must have regarded this with absolute wonder. We find that they were throwing in the Iron Age, they were throwing coins into the spring. It was a sacred spring. It must have been incredible for them because you're getting this bubbling water coming out, a pall of steam over the whole thing. The water brings out a bright red iron oxide, so all the ground around is stained like blood almost. It must have been absolutely astonishing for people. And then the Romans come along. And they love this sort of thing. They believe in the chthonic deities and the power of the springs and things like that. So they sort of tame this sacred spring by building a wall around it, really, and then using that as the focus of a great temple which was built and the focus of a great healing bathing establishment. And if you come to Bath now, you can visit quite a lot, well, most of the bathing establishment, and see quite a lot of the temple, because the bathing establishment was dug up in the end of the 19th century, and we excavated quite a lot of the temple in the 1980s, 1990s. So, but then, you see, it continues. When the Romans go, the Saxons come along. The Saxons have invaded Britain. They eventually get to this western part of Britain. And here are all these old Roman ruins. And there is actually a marvelous Saxon poem called The Ruin, which in the Anglo-Saxon language talks about these ruined buildings with the water, hot water seeping out of them. And then the Saxons sort of develop, build a church and cemeteries. Then in the medieval period, we're getting now after the Norman invasion in 1066, in the medieval period, people build proper baths here and come and bathe in the sacred water, and that's curative water. So it's a real, most of our sites, or many of our sites, have got this incredible continuity about them.
Is that called Bath because of the baths, or Bath called Bath exactly because of that place?
No. It's called Bath simply because it's a Saxon word. It's where people went to have a bath. Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about, because I noticed I'm just following along with one of the biographies I found from you. And after Danebury, tell us a little bit about the Danebury Environs Program, it says here, and just tell us what that was.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as I said, we spent 20 years excavating, 20 seasons. I mean, 20 years sounds a long time, but 20 seasons, 20 months, in fact, or a bit more than that, excavating the hill fort. And then we asked ourselves a question, which indeed you asked earlier, what's going on in the countryside around? So we then developed, we looked at all the air photographs we could get. We had lots of additional air photographs flown, plotted all the archaeological sites around the hill fort for a very considerable distance around. There were other hill forts around as well. So we decided to try and put it all together in what was called the Danebury Environs Programme, which was focused to start with on the Iron Age. So we then chose two other hill forts to look at, one called Woolbury and one called Bury Hill, which we examined on a smaller scale to compare with Danebury. And then we looked at four or five farmsteads around Danebury to see what when they were in use and how they related to Danebury. And then we were finding that a number of these farmsteads continued on into the Roman period, and they became, some of them actually became Roman villas. Mm-hmm. Some people in Britain sort of thought that when the Romans came, they came along with their great Roman culture and plonked villas down in the landscape. Well, it wasn't like that at all. When the Romans came, there were thriving farms all over the countryside, and these farmers simply continued, or their families simply continued to farm them, and became more and more and more Romanized until they got enough money to put in a new heating system or something like that in the Roman manner. If they got really a lot of money, they could hire someone to put a mosaic down. So that's how these villas grew. So what we were interested in doing was seeing the continuity of farming from the Iron Age right through to the Roman period, right up to the Saxon period, when they really did end. The end of the Roman period was a fairly dramatic time, and a number of these villas were actually destroyed and went out of use. So on some of these villa sites, we've got them starting in the Late Bronze Age, so we're talking about starting about 1000 BC, and continuously occupied right through to about 400 AD. And that's the sort of picture of continuity that we've got, certainly in southern Britain, where there are a lot of people for a lot of the time, and the land was good and could support large populations.
You know, that's it's really interesting. One of the things you were talking about there just made me think about some bigger questions. Like when you said you're expanding out, wondering what's going on in the area. You know, over here in the United States, when I'm working on some kind of project, I mean, always in the back of my head is, in an area, is when did people first come into this area? It's always big questions that we have. You know, we think we have some of it, you know, figured out, but other stuff we just don't. So what are some of the bigger questions in British archaeology that maybe remain unanswered or are unclear? You know, you might have some partial answers, some stuff that you guys are still really puzzling over.
Yeah, well, I think we've been made to think absolutely afresh by the very early results that are coming out of work on ancient DNA, looking at the genetics of not modern populations, looking at the genetics of the ancient populations from the bones buried in archaeological sites. It's really beginning to come on stream in Europe, Western Europe. In the last 4 or 5 years, I think, and we're beginning to get enough data, and it is stunning what it is making us think. For example, in Britain, we used to think that Britain was linked reasonably peacefully to the continent in the period from the Neolithic period, when Neolithic farmers came in, through into the Bronze Age. And we find a phase which we call the Beaker phase, when there are very distinctive pots and burial styles appearing. And we've tended to interpret that in the past as the result of contact and trade and exchange and possibly intermarriage and things like that. What the DNA, ancient DNA, looks as though it's showing, and this was only the last year or so, is that there was a major replacement of population in Britain sometime around about 2000 BC, with these Beaker people with their own very distinct genetic signatures coming in and replacing a large slab of the British population. And that is, you know, that really does take some thinking about and reworking all our old theories. You can imagine how shattering that would be. Now, you know, did they come in and kill people? Or did they come in and bring diseases? And that killed people. So the next bit of this work, I think, must be trying to find the DNA of the pathogens, which might still be associated with the bones. So it opens up a huge new field, absolutely stunning new field.
That's awesome, because preservation over there in the landscape in general is fairly decent for human remains and bone material, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is all the time that people were inhuming. It's mm-hmm. great, but unfortunately, there was a period in the Bronze Age when cremation was the main form mm-hmm. of disposal, and that's not good for genetic work. But in the crucial periods when these changes are taking place, in the early Bronze Age, the Beaker period, they were inhuming, and then later on, of course, we're very interested in. There's a big debate about the Saxon invasion. It is culturally a big divide in Britain. Mm-hmm. But how many people actually came across? And again, the ancient DNA is beginning to help us look at this problem.
So are you finding that you can almost, with the ancient DNA, that there's the possibility of sort of tracking lineages and identifying some of, especially with things like the Norman invasion, identifying, okay, these are individuals who are coming across and sort of bringing DNA, genetic material into the country?
It's a little bit cruder than that. What they're doing is they're bringing their DNA into the country. And we can tell if it's sort of alien DNA to what was here before. So, for example, mm-hmm. in the Neolithic period, we've got some signatures on the DNA. We're talking about very few samples at the moment because the method's just starting. But we can recognize what the DNA of a normal British Neolithic population is. And it's very much Atlantic linked. And then suddenly we get these new signatures coming in with this new culture, the beaker culture, and these signatures link essentially back to the steppe, back to the Ukraine and southern Russian steppe, when there was a movement of people into northern Europe. And it seems we're in Britain getting the sort of tail end, the last sort of throes of that movement. So of course it took place over a period of time, but and similarly, if you sort of go on a bit, fast forward to the Vikings. The Vikings started raiding Britain. You know, Vikings from Norway and Denmark started raiding Britain in the 8th century AD. There's been a lot of work on Viking DNA, and that can easily be recognized. A lot of the Scottish population has got really solid Viking DNA in it, coming in at that time. So there's a huge amount of potential for this work. And I reckon over the next 20 years, or possibly only the next 10 years, you know, if we put all our effort into getting these ancient DNA signatures sorted out, we could almost put archaeology on a hold and wait until this is sorted out and then come back to the archaeology.
Nice. Well, I think we're going to go to break in about a minute, but before we do, I'll just ask you about something a little fun that I saw in your bio. It says that you were the inspiration for the name of a character named Current Bunliff in a 1979
yes.
book.
Yeah, I can't live that one down.
It's on the internet. It's down forever now.
I know. David McCauley, who is an American and does some wonderful books, City and Cathedral Underground and books like that, which really are sort of comic strip books that take the world apart and make it great fun for kids. He wanted to do a book on archaeology, it's called Motel of the Mysteries. Mm-hmm. I knew him well at one stage, and I remember in my home we were both sitting on the floor drinking whiskey, talking about this book, and I suggested various things, and we had a hilarious time. Anyway, he then went away and wrote this book, and it's all based on a motel being excavated by archaeologists, and they discover the toilet and regard this as the great focal ritual center of the whole establishment where people worshipped and so on. You know, it's just such a fun book. And he said he'd get me in it somehow, and so he did. I've never forgiven him.
Nice. That's awesome. I'm going to have to check that out now. All right. Well, we've got a bunch more questions to ask, and we'll try to get them all done in the last segment, and we'll come back in just about 30 seconds and start that up.
This network is supported by our listeners. You can become a supporting member by going to arcpodnet.com/members and signing up. As a supporting member, you have access to high-quality downloads of each show and a discount at our future online store, and access to show hosts on a members-only Slack team. For professional members, we'll have training shows and other special content offered throughout the year. Once again, go to arcpodnet.com/members to support the network and get some great extras and swag in the process. That's arcpodnet.com/members.
Okay, we're back, and we're finishing up this fascinating discussion with Sir Barry Cunliffe. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, just because I spent some time there, and it's such a small kind of place, but it mentions in one of your biographies that you worked in the island of Jersey. Now, what what Americans might not know is there's the Channel Islands between England and France there down on the southeastern side is a string of islands. And I spent about 2 months on Jersey back in, I think, 2004 or five, something like that. I had a friend that actually worked for the BBC there, and she's like, yeah, come out for the summer. And I just came out, and I ended up, just because I was, you know, getting a little bored sitting in her house all the time, I ended up working in a coffee shop just for fun, because it was an interesting time. But anyway, I went all around that island. I actually had my bicycle shipped out there, and it was a great place. So tell us what you did on Jersey, because I'm really, that island was so fascinating with its history.
Okay. Well, I'm interested in the whole group of these Channel Islands. And as you say, they're in the English Channel, but they're very close to the French coast. And really, they're part of France. And the French, of course, don't like us having them. So they refer to them as the Île Anglo-Normande rather than the Channel Islands. Mm-hmm. They've been English since the medieval period. They are linked. They're part of this great Atlantic Seaway, which people use to communicate right from Spain, even from Morocco, right up the Atlantic coast, across past these islands to Britain. Jersey. I was looking at an Iron Age fortress there, a place called Rozelle. We didn't find very much, but we found enough to sort of characterize it. I did some more work on Guernsey, which is actually, dare I say it, in the period that interests me, it's a more interesting island. The islands are, as you know, they're pretty well, they fight with each other sometimes anyway. Guernsey is a great island, and it was one of the main ports that the Iron Age traders used when, I mentioned earlier, they were bringing wine from France to Britain in the just before the Roman invasion. Well, some of the wine ships actually stopped off at Guernsey before they made the last haul across the Channel to get to southern Britain. Mm-hmm. So we were examining sites of that period. And I'm working now, and I don't know whether you visited it. North of Jersey is the tiny island of Sark. And it's famous. You've heard of it, I'm sure.
Yeah, we did.
It's famous because it doesn't have any cars on it, and it's ruled it's ruled by a seigneur who has the lease on the island from the Queen. And this goes back to Queen Elizabeth's time, when the first seigneur sort of persuaded Queen Elizabeth to let him have the island. And the present Queen allows the current seigneur to have the island. It's just gone on and on and on. And the seigneur has to pay the Queen the same as they did in the Elizabethan period, which I think about just over £1 a year for the lease of the island, something like that. It was on that island that in the 18th century they discovered a hoard known as the Sark Hoard, which is absolutely remarkable. It was a pot dug up by farm labourers, and it had in it a number of Gaulish coins of the period of about the first century BC. But it also had bits of probably a horse harness, which were silver fittings, which were decorated in repoussé style, let's say, were beaten up from the back into sort of decorative forms. And these were fabulous animals, sea beasts and other fabulous animals, quite unlike anything found in Western Europe. And these actually were almost certainly made in what is now Bulgaria or Romania. Hmm. Now, how on earth these bits of treasure moved right across Europe to eventually be buried on this tiny little island. It's only 3 kilometers long by 2 kilometers wide. But I think the answer is that they were buried in a religious site, and that Sark had a really important religious function. It was a sort of central island, and it was rather remote. You couldn't easily get to it. It's got cliffs around it. And I think it was something of a sacred island in the past, and this was an offering of enormous value that was brought to the island and buried in a pot and found 1800 years later.
So as we're talking about trade and movement of goods and these islands, especially during things like the Iron Age. I'm just wondering, what are these Iron Age boats looking like that are navigating the open sea long distances?
Okay, well, we do know about these, fortunately. It's a tradition of boat building which we call Romano-Celtic, because the tradition starts in the Iron Age, and they're still building boats in the same tradition in the Roman period in the English Channel, and we actually have some of the remains of those boats. There's one of the boats of the Roman era was found in the harbour of St. Peterport on Guernsey, so by maritime archaeologists. And we know that this tradition continued because we've got some coins of the Iron Age which show little boats on them. And we've also got Julius Caesar's description of the boats that the Veneti, which were people who were living on in Brittany, which is close by, living in Brittany, were using when he was conquering Brittany in 57 BC. And they're plank built. Caesar is very impressed by how sturdy they are, very thick planks. The planks are overlapping. He says they're joined with nails, massive nails as thick as a man's thumb. They've got sails of rawhide. They're cross-rigged with these rawhide sails. He says either because they don't have any linen, which isn't true, they did have linen, or because they thought that the Atlantic gales needed something tough like hide for the sails. And then they have great anchor chains and anchors of iron. And indeed, an iron anchor chain and an iron anchor of just this date was dug up in the county of Dorset on the south coast of Britain about 100 years ago. So we've got quite a lot of evidence of these boats, sturdy plank-built boats. Caesar was really impressed. He said they've got high sides. The Roman boats couldn't really come near them. They were so strong and solid. And they were, he said, they're absolutely built to cope with the Atlantic gales. So that's one kind of boat. The other kind a boat, of course, is the skin boat, the boat that made of a very, very light, which we talked about in previously, made of wicker work, covered in skins, smaller boats which actually bob on the waves. And some of these also had were square rigged, but they were mainly rowing boats, but the sail was used on some occasions. So the two types of boats are really tough, nailed together planks, and then these little light skin boats.
This is a bit of an esoteric question, but has anyone tried to reconstruct any of these boats and experiment with sailing in them?
Yes, someone, the skin boat tradition, we know the Irish monks use skin boats. Some of the monks use the skin boat to get to Iceland, for example. And there's this tradition of St. Brendan, one of the great Irish traditions, about the saint who went out on a boat and sailed around the seas and found lots of mysterious islands and then came back again. And he had a skin boat. It's described in detail. And Tim Severin, the maritime archaeologist, built a skin boat like the boat described by St. Brendan, and he actually sailed it and found it was really very effective. You can sail very easily on a skin boat. So the answer is yes, they have. No one has yet built one of the plank built boats. That would be a bit more expensive to do, but I mean, it ought to be done. It would be interesting to do, but. I think someone will get round to it. Experimental archaeology is very strong in Britain, and people are keen to do this sort of thing. You learn all sorts of things that you wouldn't otherwise learn if you do experiments. You know, you think they did it this way, you try and do it this way, and you find they didn't do it this way. So you learn a lot.
You know, one thing I was remembering too, when I was in Jersey, where I was staying was, I think, on the north side of the island, and just around the corner from there, I mean, you could see France. Like you mentioned how close it was, you could see France. And when the tide went out, I mean, it was really tempting to just try to walk there. It was like, it went way out. You wouldn't need much of a boat to cross that gap.
No, you wouldn't. And indeed, in the Neolithic period, so we go back to about 4000 BC, Jersey was almost certainly linked, you know, direct to France. Mm-hmm. You could walk from France right across to Jersey. Guernsey wasn't. Guernsey was an island then. But you mentioned when the tide goes up, because there is quite a massive tide there, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can see these great shelves of rock, granite, extending right out. And that's one of the reasons why the Romans weren't too keen to use Jersey as an intermediary base. It was very dangerous to sail around it. And mm-hmm. Guernsey is a much safer place to sail to. And that's why Guernsey gets all the Roman trade. So the rocks were a danger, a hazard.
I liked Guernsey a lot. We went there a number of weekends. It seemed way more... I don't know, relaxed, even though Jersey is a pretty relaxed place.
I prefer Guernsey, but then I would have to say that because I work with a lot of Guernseymen on site. So.
Nice. And I did remember, too, it was 2004 that I was there because I was there when they were celebrating their... and I remember as an American thinking, you know, I'm from Washington State, and I think we celebrated our 100th anniversary of statehood or something, you know, back in like 1989 or something. But Jersey was celebrating their 800-year anniversary of when they came under British rule, I guess, and kind of separated.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yes, exactly. It's but of course, they could go back a lot further than that if they wanted to.
And there's... there was a castle on the south of, I think it was in St. Helier, and it was that was being excavated while I was there, and they weren't very forthcoming with information to tourists, but they were excavating, you know, it was pre-800, and they said that castle, I mean, they just keep going down, and it was a nice place to set up, and they just find, you know, occupations going as far down as they could go.
Yeah, and now at the moment, there are people excavating Paleolithic sites on the island.
Wow.
Hunter-gatherer sites. It's promising to be one of the major sites for that period now. So
nice.
There's plenty there. I've been working on Sark for the last 13 years.
Nice.
Very small scale excavation, but not about 10 people working for a couple of weeks every year. But every time we come up with something very new, you know, from the Neolithic period, right up to recent times. The most recent archaeology on Sark is, in fact, German Second World War archaeology, because the island was occupied by the Germans, one of the few bits of British territory that the Germans actually ever got to. But, you know, the remains then, I was digging up bits of German Second World War accumulator jars from batteries in the top layer of one of my excavations. And that's as much a part of the archaeology of the island as the Roman or the Neolithic.
Nice. Yeah, one more comment on the German occupation. That's another thing I noticed, because they weren't occupied for very long, but Jersey was occupied long enough just for the Germans to lay down a bunch of train tracks, and then as soon as they left, they ripped up all the train tracks, and they're a fantastic series of trails that you can bike or walk on all across the island now.
Yeah. And there's a great underground prison there too, which is a big tourist site now.
But
I mean, the big joke was it shows how our perceptions change. Immediately after the war, all the people on Jersey and Guernsey were keen to get rid of every trace of German occupations. So they went round and tipped all the guns off the cliffs into the sea and so on. And since then, they've been trying to get them back to put them up for tourists to see.
Nice. All right. So we've only got a few minutes left. Have you done any work? I'm trying to find something here, but have you done work outside of the UK and outside of that to try to link some of this stuff together? Yeah. Let's talk about that a little bit.
I've worked in Brittany, the sort of the other side of the channel, and excavated sites of the Iron Age and Roman period there. Again, looking at the trade links across the channel. One of the sites I excavated, it's near where I now live for part of the year in Brittany. It's a place called Lyode. We found plenty of evidence of cross-channel trade between that part of France and Britain throughout the Iron Age and Roman period. So, and then extending it down, I did quite a lot of work in Spain, in the Rioja, in the north, and in Andalusia in the south, in the very hot south, looking again at these contacts between, in that case, in the south, I was looking at contacts between the Mediterranean and the Mediterranean Sea and the native communities. And in the north, I was more interested in what we could link into the Atlantic and how we could see trade coming across Spain to the Atlantic. Working in Andalusia, as I said, it was very, very hot, and the wine was pretty ordinary. So when I was working with a Spanish colleague, and when we'd finished that particular piece of work, you know, she said, shall we do another project together? And I sort of jumped at the chance, and she said, well, you know, any preferences? And I said, well, somewhere where the wine's better. So she said, I know, let's go to Rioja. So we went to Rioja and spent a very happy 6 or 7 years there.
That's awesome. All right, well, we've only got a couple minutes left, and as I mentioned at the beginning, we recorded a show, episode 24, check that out in the show notes, about your new book that's coming out, On the Ocean, and I think it's coming out in the U.S. later this year. And do you have, you know, what are you working on anything else that you have coming up in the next few years that you're trying to maybe synthesize all this amazing knowledge you've accumulated?
Well, I've
that you can talk about?
Yeah, I've gone back to my old love, to the Celts. About 20 years ago, I wrote a book on the Celts, mm-hmm. Published by Oxford University Press, called The Ancient Celts. And so much has happened. I've spent quite a lot of time researching the origin of the Celts since then. So much has happened that OUP have asked me to produce a new edition of the book. So that's going through the press at the moment and should be published in, I'm just looking at some of the maps today. It should be published in April, I think, March or April. And then meanwhile, I'm writing a companion book to the Celts on the Scythians, the people who occupied the steppe, really, from, you know, right across the central of Eurasia through Kazakhstan and into Russia, southern Russia, and the Ukraine. These wonderful nomadic peoples with brilliant art, horse riders who impinged dramatically on Europe for about 800 years. So the Scythian, I'm deep in the Scythians and deep in the steppe at the moment, but I've got one or two other ideas for when the Scythians are done.
Nice. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Barry. And I do have one actually final question, and I don't care if we're going over time, because you are the first that I've been aware of. You were the first knighted archaeologist or person in general I've had to talk to. How did that happen? How did you become Sir Barry Cunliffe?
Well, it's all a total mystery. No one knows how it happens. But you simply get a letter from the mm-hmm. Prime Minister's office saying the Prime Minister is minded, it's very carefully written, the Prime Minister is minded to recommend to the Queen that she might consider appointing you a knight. Would this be acceptable? You see, so what do you say to that?
Right.
But, but so you write back and say, well, it sounds like a good idea, thanks. And then it happens. So what goes on in the background, I don't know. Someone somewhere probably came up with the idea that we ought to have a few more archaeologists who are knights, and sort of looked down a list and said, that one will do.
That'll
do. It's as simple as that. Yep.
Nice. Well, again, thanks a lot. And for our listeners, go check out the links in the show notes. Check out episode 24 of the show to hear about his new book, On the Ocean. And again, thank you, Sir Barry Cunliffe.
Thank you very much indeed, Chris and April.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show was produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song, I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.